This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kathleen Dunn. An article in the New York Times last week caught our attention titled, "A Best Friend? You Must Be Kidding." It says that increasingly some educators and other professionals who work with children are asking a question that might surprise their parents. Should a child really have a best friend? Parents sometimes say Johnny needs that one special friend, and we say he doesn't need a best friend, some parents are saying. The attitude is a manifestation of a mindset that has led adults to become ever more involved in children's social lives in recent years. And for many child-rearing experts, the ideal situation might be having a whole pack of children over for an afternoon of fun. And not just expecting one person to like more than you might like others. Our guest this hour has some questions about this new idea, and she is Professor Niobe Way, a professor of applied psychology at the New York University and president of the Society for Research on Adolescence. We'll be talking with her about best friends, about this article, and we hope with you as well. I think this could be a really interesting conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You could send an email, too, if you'd like to do that. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor Niobe Way, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello. It's nice
Hi.
To be here.
Do you have a best friend?
Absolutely.
So do I.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a critical part of my my life.
And has that always been so when you were young?
Absolutely. It's a critical part of how I learned how to be in good relationships and have a life that involves lots of people and support, and how I thrive is through those relationships.
So you think then this idea is pretty much a lot of hooey?
Well, you know, I actually think it's actually quite dangerous, because
oh.
I think that the belief that somehow not only are best friendships not should be discouraged at some level, but that they actually, if at best, should just be tolerated, really misses the point of what allows us to thrive as human beings, quite frankly, in terms of really needing those close, intimate relationships to foster our empathy and our emotional and social skills that are so critical for everything we do, whether it's our relationships, whether it's our job, whether it's our child rearing, whether it's academic achievement. It's so critical for those kinds of, you know, the things that we want for our children as well as for ourselves, that I think it's a dangerous article in the sense that it sort of comes down on either discouraging or you know, again, at best, tolerating them, and, you know, making sure it doesn't lead to mean behavior without understanding. No, what we really need to do as parents and as professionals working in schools is actually actively fostering them and figuring out ways, especially, obviously, positive friendships and mutually supportive friendships, and helping kids to have those friendships and to maintain them over time.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk more about this, because it sounded from the article that the impetus for this "Don't Have a Best Friend" movement is an anti-bullying movement,
right?
That it's meant to head that off in some way.
That's right. Yeah, and I think that, you know, the sort of the misguided nature of it, I think, comes from seeing two things that are happening and then making, you know, a causal connection between them that don't exist. So the increase of bullying and the prevalence of bullying, the bullying research suggests really comes from kids who are oftentimes lonely, don't feel supported by other kids, feel isolated in some ways, whether it could be academically or other ways. And so they take out sort of their own desire to somehow feel good about themselves in a sort of negative way by bullying other kids. So bullying and mean behavior doesn't come from an intimate, close friendship. It really comes from actually kids not having good enough connections with each other, deep connections, not superficial ones, where they really feel supported. And kids who are deeply supported, hands down, don't engage in that kind of mean behavior that we hear about in the news and we read about.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how prevalent is this? The article made mention of this camp, a co-ed sleepaway camp in New York, and they have friendship coaches. If you go there with a very best friend, they don't put you at the same table. They put you at opposite ends, different teams, different dorm rooms, et cetera, to make sure that you get to know a lot of other people. Right. Are there a lot of places like this and schools? Are they doing this as well?
Well, you know, it's funny because when I first read it, I thought, oh, this must, you know, this seems strange to me, and I wonder how typical it really is. And then I began to sort of think about what I knew about schools and how schools work, and oftentimes schools where there's the same group of kids each year, what they'll do, which is similar to the camp, quite frankly, and this is very common, by the way, where they'll take kids who, you know, if they've been in the same classroom in, let's say, second or third grade, they'll make sure that they divide up the kids the following year so that especially two kids who really are hanging out together a lot are in separate classrooms. So you actually see that in different forms all over the place, and it really comes from somehow a belief that's truly misguided, Kathleen. I mean, at a very, very fundamental level, that somehow that sort of deep connection is problematic, and that it leads that deep connection, the deep bond that happens between kids and, quite frankly, Kathleen, as you started the interview, between adults, that's so positive in your life is actually potentially troublesome. And thus schools and camps are doing these very, I would argue, quite frankly, destructive things of, you know, separating kids who are, you know, engaged in close friendships. Now, I'm not trying to say clearly kids who are engaged in negative behavior together, you know, picking on other kids, engaging in bad behavior in all sorts of forms, you know, that they should be allowed to, you know, continue that just because they're close friends. So obviously, if you're talking about bad behavior, you need to deal with it in terms of separating kids and dealing with the bad behavior. But I'm really talking about sort of close bonds, the ones that they talked about at the beginning of the article, where they were, you know, really close friends and it was a positive, mutually supportive relationship. And that should be, if anything, you know, fostered for more kids. So it's also not just a small group of kids who are having those relationships. You know, everybody should enjoy those kinds of deep intimate friendships.
Well, there's also something, you put yourself in the mind of a child for a moment here, and to have adults telling you that you can't sit with your best friend or be in the same class with your best friend, who are you to tell me who to be friends with? I'm sorry.
Exactly. Well, exactly. No, I mean, you just have to smile a little bit, because if you imagine us doing, you know, if you imagine that romantic relationships, you know, for adults are as important, certainly, for a lot of kids, and you imagine us, you know, in an intimate relationship, we should separate those people because it's somehow troublesome, the intimacy. And, you know, it's focusing on the wrong issue. The issue is that we definitely have a crisis happening in our culture around, you know, an empathy crisis, a crisis of connection, where kids are, the research is showing that there's dramatically less empathy happening among young people than 30 years ago. Apparently, according to one research project, there's been a 40% drop in empathic sort of feelings since students of the 1980s. There's lots of crisis of connections going on. Kids are not deeply connecting to each other. They're having very superficial connections. So in that context, I would argue, it's even more pressing that we have and really foster these deep, mutually supportive connections so kids can really acquire and foster their natural, you know, empathic and emotional skills. That it's critical, Kathleen, you and I know that, it's critical for everything.
Well, what's the reason for this great loss of empathy?
Well, you know, there's been lots and lots of theories, and interestingly enough, an article that came out in the UK Times, I think it was last week, talked about research where they said that the 40% drop happened most significantly in the year 2000, and so I've been thinking about sort of what happened in the year 2000 that we've seen this drop. And if you think about, you know, the most obvious thing is the extent of we're having, you know, relationships with people not face-to-face. So through social networking, through texting, through cell phones, we're not actually talking to people face-to-face for the most part, and kids certainly aren't. And so the whole question of, you know, how do you and I gain our emotional skills, the social skills, et cetera, it's oftentimes by reading each other's faces. You know, looking at your face when I talk, sort of modulating what I'm saying according to how, you know, how I'm saying it. And so if we're not doing that, if we're spending, you know, 6-7 hours on the internet and texting, and, you know, all those email fights, too, that go on, where people misinterpret what you said on the email, comes from not having that face-to-face contact or really reading each other's facial expressions, which actually helps us, right? It helps and enhances our social-emotional skills. So I would really blame a lot of it in the sort of our technology. And then also, quite frankly, you know, not just the technology. It's a larger culture that really somehow idealizes, you know, a very autonomous, independent self and doesn't value relationships on a very deep level enough, as much as it should. Given who we are as human beings.
When you, the other thing that seems to me to be happening with all this Facebook connection and all these people who go on these weird television shows and bear the deep most secrets that
That's
they
right.
have, that normally you would have
That's
done
right.
with a best friend and nobody
right.
knows. You go on the internet and you tell all about what's going on with your family
That's
and
right.
you broke up with your girlfriend and how bereft you are, et cetera. It's just strange.
That's right. Well, no, you're absolutely right. It's sort of like there is a kind of... It's a great point, actually. There is a kind of false intimacy that goes on that's pervasive. So, you know, you have, I remember buying something on off of a website, and so the person who was selling me this cell phone signed off her note saying, "Love ya." And I just thought it was just so funny to me because I thought it's this real pervasive false intimacy
right.
That happens, but it's not genuine intimacy that really happens between two best friends and that really fosters a sense of trust and a sense of confidence in who you are. But you're absolutely right that, you know, the illusion of intimacy is dangerous because then you can say, well, I have, you know, 250 best friends. What are you talking about? You know, I don't not have any best friends. I have, you know, hundreds of them. but it's not the same kind of thing because it's not really fostering what needs to be fostered, which is a real sense of trust in the world and who you are and that you're a valuable person in the world. And that comes from really having those very deep, deep connections.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes from face-to-face, you know, engagement.
Well, what's happening? Tell me more about what's happening with this with adolescents, because if you have a best friend, and I do too, and I have a lot of very close friendships, there's nothing better than getting together, and we make dates to do this all the time, to go have a cup of coffee and usually a piece
That's
of
right.
cake or something to go with it,
yep.
and just talking, and we talk for hours, and it goes by quickly, and we cover, and there's nothing more deeply enriching than that.
Yeah,
Are
yeah.
young people forsaking that for computers, et cetera, that kind of deep friendship that, as you say, only comes from face-to-face and, for me, by conversation, or maybe I'm just living in another generation?
Right. No, I think people are forsaking that, and I think we're seeing the consequences. I mean, there's now been some fascinating health-based research among adults showing that those with close friendships are less likely to get colds. There's been an amazing body of research showing that on middle-aged men where they showed that close friendships were more predictive of lower rates of heart disease than even spouses. Which is remarkable to me.
Isn't that something?
So there's more and more research really showing the benefits, the physical health and mental health benefits of close friendships among adults. And certainly what's happening is that kids are, you know, particularly teenagers and late teenagers are forsaking that kind of one-to-one contact. But I have to say in our research, and this is the research I've been doing for so many decades at this point, they explicitly talk about their desire for those deep connections. And so even if they're not having them, you, as you saw in the article, you get these, if when you begin to talk to teenagers, they recognize the absence. And so they'll oftentimes say things like, boys and girls, by the way, not just girls. Boys, you know, 16, 17-year-old boys will talk about how much they yearn for deep connections with other boys. And, you know, in our culture, that kind of connection by the time you're 17 or 18 is considered so-called gay. So boys hesitate to sort of engage in those kinds of relationships. And girls have a hard time finding those deep connections with other girls because, you know, our larger culture, once again, just really doesn't value them. We think that what you should be doing when you're 18 is going to college and then eventually looking for a romantic partner. We don't take seriously as a culture the critical nature of, you know, close, intimate, mutually supportive friendships in our lives. And, you know, I think, Kathleen, I think we know it. We know it's important intuitively.
Sure we do.
But I think we don't, you know, we don't foster it in the younger generation. We don't foster it among, you know, in our family. I mean, I just don't think we take it seriously enough. Yet, the research indicates that it's critical.
Well, it's unfortunate we don't take it seriously. We're going to welcome phone calls. We have many of them coming in already, so I think a lot of you in our audience realize how important it is. Our guest this hour is Professor Niobe Way, Professor of Applied Psychology at New York University and President of the Society for Research on Adolescence. She has spent, as you heard her say, a number of years studying best friendships, and her research has brought her to the opposite conclusion than the article that we have been referencing. We have one line open. No, we don't. Just keep the number in mind. 800-486-8655. And we also have an email address, which you can send an email. We'd like to have you just come and share a cup of coffee with us, but we can't do that. And actually, I think radio is a fairly intimate medium, so it's one of the reasons I chose it. So we can't see you face-to-face, but we can hear you. To your calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and let's start with Bill in Oshkosh. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good morning. I don't know if you can hear me very well. Can you?
Yeah, there's a little bit of noise in the background, but you're coming through.
I'll go into a place that's cluttered.
Okay.
Well, just maybe two humorous anecdotes about intimacy. One in marriage. I think somebody was talking on NPR about aunts and how the, what do you know, I think, and the female aunt of the species immediately kills the male immediately after making love and mating. And the response from one wise guy on the table was, so what's new? So much for marital intimacy. But the notion of best friends, I think they're throwing baby out with the bathwater. I went to a school that was a lab school in Oshkosh for the State Teachers College, and I wasn't with the children for our fellow students for 9 years, but many were for 10. I was about four, and they same class pretty much, and they fostered lifelong friendships. The women get together, some of them now, even then, and it was difficult, I think, for some students that we did pick on a little bit, but familiarity, on the other hand, made it harder. I mean, because the class really did develop close friendships, and one could come up to us and tell us that we were very wrong in this, and we stopped because we respected this person. My son came to a school near here, system which is excellent, but he had, in the fourth grade, quite a bit of bullying problems because he was different and new, and the school tried to intervene. They had a very good policy on it, but some of the kids persisted. And he finally just whacked one, and all the bullying stopped. But the turnover in classrooms there, I thought, in some ways may have inhibited, in school, may have inhibited building close friends. Another friend of mine grew up in Queens, New York, and he had 50 kids within two blocks. It was an Irish neighborhood, and he's a consummate politician, excellent at friendship, and he really has some wonderful skills, but he didn't develop these at school. So some of our living, we live rather remote, can't see kids in the afternoon. It was harder to see kids in the afternoon, and people don't mix so much as we used to in urban Oshkosh with friends on the weekend. And I think there's some issues well outside of that may create bullying, having to do with what the sociologist called anomie.
Yep.
Absolutely. Professor Way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely correct, and I actually think that it. I mean, this is going to sound. I think there's a lot of hope of things we can do to change it, but this is going to sound quite pessimistic. But I do think we're getting worse. I think we're not sort of knowing the kind of knowledge that you got when you were a child, as well as it sounds like in your son's school as well. I just think we're not understanding that it's, again, it's not just tolerating these relationships. It's that's the key to everything. it's the key to really helping children and adults learn, you know, to be with each other and to have healthy relationships, which is the essence of our human experience. And so I do think that there's a way in which we're losing touch with that, and our anomie is increasing, our sense of alienation is increasing, a sort of the technology is a product of it, but you know, I think the causes, in some ways, the deep cause is that we don't value it at some fundamental level, so we don't see it as something that has to be a critical part of school reform or a critical part of, you know, larger social policy.
Thank you so much, Bill, for the call. Mark in Richland Center, hi.
Good morning. I don't know what you're probably already aware. I heard a radio program about a culture in Asia, a guy who had written a book about people who live to be easily 100 years old. And one of these cultures, that was the most important thing that he cited for what they did, because early in childhood, the culture intentionally established for the children these relationships and told them these are going to be your lifelong friends. They're going to be what sustains you throughout your life.
That's right.
And it was fostered. It's fostered in the, and these people, you know, regularly live to be 100, but they know they have this secure group of people that will back them for everything. They're not concerned for loneliness. They're not concerned if they fall on hard times, what will happen to them.
That's right.
It's a very supportive, wonderful, loving system. And it just, it's so counter to what the rugged individualism that we foster in this country, because that's just basically insane.
That's right. I share that.
Thank you, Mark, so much for the call. We go next to Soraya from Bay City. Hello, Soraya.
Hi. You know, I can hardly believe my ears. I have to say, you know, when I was growing up, I was at a school, a Catholic school, and I had a lot of different friends, I mean, people who were nice to me. I was a shy kid, and I even had some friends who were parts of cliques, but I wasn't accepted into the clique.
Mm.
But I didn't have a best friend, and I can tell you that would have made all the difference. I had a very difficult time. And, you know, because I wasn't so outgoing and everything as the other kids, it's not like I was, like people were cruel to me or anything like that.
Mm.
But, you know, this is just crazy because, you know, and as you get older, you know, life gets harder and you have to I guess what I want to say is I do have a best friend now, and I don't know what I would do without her.
Yeah.
Because things, you know, life has gotten really tough.
Isn't that true? You use a phrase that so many best friends will say, I don't know how I could live without the person. It's really true, isn't it?
That's right. And, you know, it's also interesting. It's just that when you talk to teenagers, as my research team and I have been doing for about 2 decades, you just hear that from teenagers directly, too. So it's not as if, you know, they're so absorbed in their social networking that they don't get it. When you talk to 16-year-olds as well as 10-year-olds, as well as the 8-year-old in the article, you know, the 8-year-old in the article said, I wish I had someone I can always call. And you hear that from teenagers, that they, if they don't have one or two, they express a very clear desire for it.
Right. Here's an interesting email that's come in from John, who says, I can kind of see both sides. Best friends allows kids to put down some roots and to feel home. They are critical for kids to grow and develop emotionally. They need this type of depth. Based on the research I've read, this actually applies more to girls as opposed to boys. Keep that in mind. That being said, I can understand the risks of cliques. They are, to some degree, an informal gang based on exclusivity, but that's kind of the point, isn't it? Not all small groups are bad. I would be dead today if not for my close friends. I don't buy the bullying angle. It sounds like someone who dropped out of statistics class. Correlation does not imply causation.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think I do want to comment on the boy versus girl thing, because I think it's a common misperception, and it's striking. The email, the person who wrote the email was a man, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So, and he says at the end he needs his best friend, correct?
Yes.
I mean, I think there's a, in our research with boys, we've been looking at boys' friendships, particularly for the last decade, following teenagers over many years, looking at their best friends in particular, and what you find, and then you begin to see in other research as well, is that best friendships and intimate, close friendships, the sharing secrets type of friendships, are critical for both boys and girls. And in fact, some research has even suggested that they're more critical for boys than for girls, because they don't get it much from other relationships. And that girls have more avenues, you know, with teachers, with moms, et cetera, to have those kinds of relationships, and boys have fewer avenues. So the best friendship becomes even more critical. But even if you weren't going to say more critical, the research certainly indicates from our studies of interviewing boys, hundreds of boys over many years, that that boys, you know, want, they oftentimes have these close relationships in early adolescence, particularly, and that they absolutely want them, and they link, you know, they link to well-being. I mean, it's an interesting statistic actually in there, because boys actually, their suicide rate in comparison to girls jumps up at the age of 16 to 4 times the rate of girls, from 2 times the rate of girls in early adolescence. And right at that age, right at 16, is exactly the age that boys start to struggle with finding that one or two best friends. And they explicitly talk about that, the difficulty with maintaining close, intimate friendships and their desire for it. And that's exactly the age that suicide rates among boys jumps up. And I just can't, you know, again, you don't want to do the correlation is causation necessarily, but you definitely hear the increased sort of stories of isolation and loneliness and the desire for close friendships. And you know, and in our strange culture, we consider that, you know, pathological, and we make for boys, we make it into something that only gay kids feel.
Yeah, that
rather
makes
than how,
no sense.
You know, all boys feel,
right,
regardless of
right.
their sexual orientation.
Mm. Thanks, Soraya, for your call. John in Madison, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if you could address the role that personality plays in the depth and number of intimate relationships, and also the role that family structure or lack of family structure plays in the whole affair.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So I think sort of having an outgoing personality makes it easier. But as the mother of a very shy child and a very outgoing child, I have 2 children. One is, they're sort of opposites in terms of personality. I just know I have to work harder as a parent. My shy child is, he's 10. I have to work harder on trying to help him make the kinds of friendships that he wants to make. So I think that personality influences it, but I don't think it's a sort of dead end in terms of shy children will just suffer inevitably. I think it just entails the parent putting more work into trying to help them structure things through play dates, going on play dates, et cetera, inviting kids over to the house, et cetera. So I think you're absolutely right. The second part of your question, remind me again.
Family structure, whether
family
it's
structure.
A strong family
background. So I think, you know, what the research shows in terms of our own research as well as other people's research is that family structure does not necessarily predict the quality of the friendship, but the quality of the relationships with your parents does. So if you're having close relationships, even if it's just with your mom, you're raised by a single mom, and you're having very close, intimate, emotionally supportive relationships with your mom, you're more likely to have those types of friendships, whether it's, you know, a best friendship or a couple best friendships, et cetera. And the same with dads, by the way, too. So having a dad in the home doesn't lead to sort of, you know, more likely to have whether that's romantic partners or best friends, but having really close, intimate relationships with your parents does predict better quality friendships. And so, you know, that underscores the modeling that parents really need to take seriously, that, you know, helping your kids make good choices with relationships, you know, not getting into friendships that are mean and abusive and discouraging in any way. So, you know, parents need to take it seriously that one of their primary roles in raising children is to help their kids make good choices, relational choices, and then how do you stay in relationships, right? How do you stay in good relationships? That's hard. And just helping your kid work that through and, you know, talk it through, friendships and processing friendships at the dinner table is critical, I think. And, you know, this, then there's lots of research supporting this. But, you know, I think it's also intuitive for many of us.
Mm-hmm. You talk about helping your shy son make friendships. What's the role of schools in fostering friendships?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that parents need to take a responsibility, and definitely schools. And schools are, you see schools across the country doing different things, and I don't think there's enough attention to these schools that are really trying to foster the kinds of things that we're talking about. And schools can really do it in so many different ways. The whole climate of a school, I do a lot of research on school climate and looking at the sort of quality of the teacher-student relationships and the student-student relationships, et cetera, and the impact they have on children. And if you create a climate that really actively fosters empathy and the importance of empathy and, you know, treating each other not only with respect, clearly, but really, you know, imagining what it's like to be another person and the feelings of another person, and that becomes a core part of integrated into the curriculum. And I've seen it done in schools where that really becomes a core part. Another strategy I've seen schools take is advisory groups, but not just, you know, sort of superficial advisory groups, but where you have advisory groups, you meet with the same group of students and the same teacher over a period sometimes of years in high school, for example, where you know, and the point of that advisory group is to really foster connections in the school and foster deep connections among kids. And then as well as, you know, it sounds almost so obvious that I think people, you know, when I say it, it sounds a little silly, but it's really important. So even the things of, you know, when we read novels, for example, in our English class, oftentimes in elementary schools we'll talk about the relationships in the novels and the dynamics of the relationships to foster that with young children. But by the time they get to, you know, middle or high school, we'll sort of talk about other, well, we'll talk about the relationships. We won't really talk about the sort of the relational moral of the story in the novel, really trying to do that when they actually engage with material, reading books, talking about them, talking about how they relate to your own relationships in your life, and really helping kids, you know, helping them have good relationships is something schools can really do, and they would do if they understood the critical nature of that for kids doing well in school.
Right.
Right?
Yeah,
I mean,
I agree.
Don't make a link to it, you're not going to do it because you're thinking, well, what does that have to do with academic achievement?
Yeah, well,
but it does. And, you know, that's not just my opinion. That's out of decades of research showing the link between feeling connected in school to your peers and to your teachers and doing better in school.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email that would appear the opposite might be happening from Barb in Green Bay. My children attend a small Catholic school. When I was in elementary school, I always looked forward to lunch so I could sit next to my friends. My children dread lunch because the principal assigned seats daily so that no one feels left out. My fourth grade daughter was repeatedly seated next to the class bully and could not sit next to her friends. Sometimes they are seated boy, girl, which doesn't create friendships but causes problems. Isn't there some kind of saying that if you have one close, true friend, you are luckier than having many so-so friends? As adults, we know that you don't have to get along with everyone.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, it's what the previous listeners indicated. We're making a connection between two things that aren't connected. We're thinking that because obviously we want to discourage bullying, we want to discourage mean behavior, we want kids to feel like they're, you know, they're friends with like a lot of kids in the school. I mean, clearly that's an important value, and so you see these schools thinking, well, I want to make sure there's no, you know, negative, cliquish behavior, so we're going to circulate kids constantly. But again, it's assuming that somehow that's linked, you know, that behavior is linked to close relationships, and I would say it's the opposite, that deep, close relationships prevents mean behavior. You know, it literally prevents it. It allows someone to feel good about themselves and good in the world, and thus they, you know, more empathic, right?
More skilled
emotionally and socially. So they wouldn't ever, you know, do something as mean as we hear about in the news.
So what do you do with that bully?
Well, I think, honestly, I mean, you know, this is something that I've been thinking about for a long time, and I don't do research directly on it, but I've certainly read a lot about it. I mean, I think you have to think of him as, think of him or her, and it's more likely to be a him, but it's oftentimes her too, as someone who's actually quite isolated and lonely. Figuring out how do you, first of all, stop the behavior immediately. That's the first, right? This, it cannot continue that this person is making other kids feel unsafe. So whether it's, you know, some kind of disciplinary action. But then I think the intervention really is to try to figure out ways to help this kid feel more connected in some ways, whether they, you know, whether they're part of some kind of peer counseling group that happens in the school, that's happening in many schools across the country, where they get kids, where they get boys or girls together, and they can talk about the difficulties they've been experiencing in the past with each other, and really building a safe community. And, you know, you have to treat the bully as not inherently a mean kid. You have to treat him as someone who's, you know, basically quite isolated, and is, this is his sort of desperate attempt to try to get attention and to try to get kids to sort of think he's cool or et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Linda in La Crosse, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, Linda, how are you?
Good. I have a little different perspective. My dad was an Air Force officer, and we moved all the time. Mm. And we kind of had longings for friends and to find out what happened to them.
Mm.
So we lived in New York in a mixed neighborhood. But those are the days when you went out in the evening. Everyone went out and played in the street and tennis. And I longed to find out what happened to my friend. I was 12. I'm now 62.
Mm.
And through, you know, by hook and by crook, I found her.
Oh.
And I found out, you know, what happened to her and if she had a family. And when I told the rest of the family, my brother said, oh, my goodness. Maria's best friend was my friend Chris.
Oh.
So we called again and got a hold of Chris.
Oh.
So isn't that something, two families reconnecting after 50 years?
Oh.
Beautiful.
Isn't
absolutely
that
beautiful.
Great? So
yeah.
how was that great? How was she, your friend?
She was the kind of girl I thought would marry and have children, and instead she went on to become a, you know, get her master's degree and do all this PR work, and totally different.
Huh.
Totally. But that was, I was still happy to know it. I was
right.
Still happy to know. And the boy who was very shy went on to get a PhD, and he writes columns for newspapers. So my brother, too, was shocked just to know what happened to him.
Yeah, yeah.
That they didn't drop off the face of the earth, that we still had that connection.
That's right.
Was wonderful.
Oh, yeah, I'll
was
bet
wonderful.
It was. I love
if
this
didn't
story.
You have bullies then, if you didn't like the child, you just didn't play with them.
Yeah. Right. Well, it also just speaks to the depth of those connections we build at an early age. I mean, it just speaks to the intensity of the importance of that relationship that we yearn to know, you know, what happened to them, and it's so gratifying to find them.
It sure is. Our guest this hour is Dr. Niobe Way, a professor of applied psychology, New York University, and president of the Society for Research on Adolescence. Best friends. There are many schools. Some people who are in the business of understanding children are saying it's not a good thing for children to have best friends, and are taking steps, some schools, some camps, to make sure that best friends cannot sit with each other at lunch or be on the same teams or be in the same dorms. Our guest is saying that's way off base, and we're explaining why. More phone calls in a moment. Linda, thanks for your call. One line open, 800-486-8655. Email address, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Roger from Reedsburg, our next call. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I think the whole idea of not allowing kids to have best friends is just bad, because I have friends that I've been friends with since kindergarten when we first met.
Mm.
And one of my best friends I've known since eighth grade, and all these friends I've had throughout school, we still get together and do things. And the one I call my best friend, he and I are business partners right now.
Mm.
And a lot of times throughout, you know, my life through school and afterwards, if I didn't have those close connections, I don't know if I would have been able to get through some of the things and some of the challenges I had in my life. I mean, if it weren't for my best friend when my father passed away, I don't know what would have happened. So...
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting because you just hear that so often. I mean, I just, you know, in listening to young adults and to teenagers and to adults, we just hear that in the last, you know, 15, 20 years. We've heard that so many times, exactly what you just said, just the critical nature of it. And I just want to add, you know, it's interesting because I don't think you're going to probably find many people who will say best friends are irrelevant and they're not important. But the interesting thing is what this article suggests, but there's many policies happening that don't understand the true importance of those relationships. So even when you're, you know, putting kids at different tables at lunchtime every lunch period, or you're not allowing friendships to sit at the same table, et cetera, you know, you're doing something that's not actually acknowledging what you just told us about your best friend. And so I just want to, for the viewers, I just think it's important, or the listeners rather, I think it's important to recognize that it's, I don't think there's really many of us who are out there saying, you know, best friendships are bad for you. But I do think there's a lot of policy going on, a lot of activity going on in schools, et cetera, that really do diminish the importance of that friendship.
Let's talk about opposite sex friendships for a moment. How important are those? How difficult are those, particularly for children?
Right. I mean, I think that you're seeing, first of all, you're seeing an increase in opposite sex friendships, so that you're seeing much more than you used to, boys and girls hanging out with each other, especially by the time they're teenagers. When they're 8, 9, and 10, it's almost all gender segregated. But by the time they're 13, 14, and 15, you're seeing much more kids, you know, boys and girls hanging out with each other and developing close friendships. I think in many ways it's something that can be challenging, but I wouldn't say necessarily more challenging than a same-sex friendship. And in some sense, as you get older, I would argue that it would be less challenging because it's less, certainly for boys, it's less taboo to be close with a girl than it is to be really intimate and close with a boy by the time you're 16 or 17. And so I think that, you know, it's something that should be acknowledged as different from a same-sex friendship in the sense that you're, you know, dealing with different pressures and different expectations. But I do think the challenge of same-sex friendship in a culture that doesn't value same-sex friendships it makes it even more difficult for those relationships to thrive, particularly starting in late adolescence.
We go next to Anthony in Racine. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Kathleen. Welcome back from your vacation.
Thanks, Anthony.
You have a great topic again this morning, and welcome to the professor. This is a very interesting topic, and while I was listening to the introduction, I was kind of set aback because to have an intermediary in the development of adolescence is actually ludicrous.
That's right.
I think it's the foundation for human development. My mother is a special ed school teacher back in the 60s and 70s, and, you know, she was always talking with the family about how to deal with or how to teach emotionally developed children. And friendship is a very important element of any child's development, not only as an adolescent but as a human being. I'm also reminded of a number of enormously close collaborations between people that we all know. Say, for instance, like Paul McCartney and John Lennon.
That's right.
Recently, there was an interview with Paul McCartney. He was saying that once the Beatles had been established, John Lennon and Paul McCartney had an enormously strong bond, and the common denominator of that bond was that both of them had lost their mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, secretly had a crying moment because they both understood what it was like not having their mothers. So it formed an enormously strong bond between them.
I mean, I'm
sure there's some other collaborations, you know, with these unique friendships that we talk about, Google, Yahoo, and so many other musical, artistic, you know, unisons.
Yeah.
And I've tell you, I have some very unique friendships, and I couldn't get this far if I didn't have them. So mm-hmm. having an intermediary or a monitor, you know, separating, you know, close friends, I think is ludicrous. Mm-hmm. And I think I've eaten up enough time. But I think this is a great topic, and I'll take my response off.
Okay, Anthony. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I think it's just, you know, it's just striking, Kathleen, just the same, right? It's the same sort of passion for each listener.
Yes, yes.
Regarding the importance of these friendships and just thinking about the ways in which, you know, the problem of not valuing them is pervasive. And even though listener after listener is calling in saying, this is crazy, and yet we still have these, you know, policies at camps, at schools that somehow say, you know, we need to be making sure kids are friends with everybody rather than building these close friendships. And it just, it's remarkable the difference between what people are saying and then what's actually
sure
happening.
Sure is. So what do you recommend people do about that? If the research seems to show just the opposite, and we know in ourselves it shows the opposite, what if that's the policy at school or the policy at camp?
That's right. Well, I think it's just to openly talk about it more. So, for example, in the school my children go to, trying to make it as much of a conversation with whether you're talking with the principal, whether you're talking with teachers, whether you're talking to your child at night at over the dinner table, really talking about these issues and talking about it with your friends who have kids, your friends who don't have kids, you know, just making it more out in the public discussion about why these relationships are so important to you in your own life, as well as, you know, in your children's lives. And I think that trying to put it, you know, more clearly on the table that, again, it's not that we should just tolerate these relationships. We should be thinking about ways in schools and in the home of actually trying to foster these. And I just want to make one comment. Sometimes with parents, in the article, for example, she said her young boy, her 8-year-old, wanted to have a best friend, but she found organizing a play date with this one boy he liked too complicated. And that's a common, I know that feeling as a mother of two children, that it can feel too complicated to do these play dates, and it takes, for some people, it takes driving across town and et cetera. And I think that we really need to, however, put the effort into helping our children do that and helping, you know, figure out ways to make those friendships happening. So driving across town and making the play date happen and making the, you know, when they're young. And then when they're older, having, obviously you don't do that any longer, but having a place in which your child's friend can come over to the house and, you know, engage with their friend in an intimate way. And I think that there's a way, lots of different ways, talking about it, you know, helping our children do it, talking to your child's school, talking to your peers about it, that can really make it more in the center of people's minds. In some ironic way, Kathleen, these articles are sort of perfect because it helps draw attention to the problem,
yeah.
Which is the problem is not the best friend. The problem is that we actually think these are sort of, you know, to be tolerated rather than to be fostered.
Mm-hmm. Wayne in Appleton, hi.
Hi. This kind of relates to the opposite sex question earlier. I was at a meeting about 4 years ago, and the person that was leading the meeting asked the guys if they considered their wife their best friend.
Mm.
And 80-90% of the guys put their hand up, yes, their wife was their best friend.
Mm.
Then he asked the question of the women that were there, do you consider your husband your best friend? And only about 20% of them raised their hands.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I was shocked. What's going on?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think, you know, we live in a culture, first of all, which we don't value friendships in general. But we certainly, when there are friendships, we certainly allow them to thrive more among women than among men. So the men I've talked to over many decades at this point are always telling me the challenges they face to maintain their previously close friendships or to develop new ones. So men, we already know, have a harder time developing close friendships, male friendships, so that they oftentimes will, you know, turn to their wives for that kind of intimacy, when in fact, marital researchers folks like Stephanie Kuntz, et cetera, will argue that that's oftentimes a problem in the marriage, is when there's no best friend outside of the relationship, the marital relationship. Whereas women will oftentimes, because they're more sort of largely supported in that desire for friendships by the larger culture, have an easier time going outside of the marriage and finding a woman friend who they're very close with. So I think that finding really reflects just a culture that sort of allows it for women and discourages it for men, and so that men, you know, simply end up turning to their wives. Now, if you would ask the men, I bet, how many of you would like a best friend with another man, I bet you'd get, 70-80% of the men raising their hand.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was one of those guys that raised their hand, being my wife as the best friend.
Yeah.
But I would certainly like to have some guy friends in my life.
That's, of course. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much. Oh, we have tons of emails. This has really struck a chord, I must say. Tons of emails yet to read. And I thank you so much for all your thoughtful conversation about this. It's something I never thought we would talk about. I assumed it was okay to have best friends, but
exactly. You
never know. Thank you so much. It was a great hour.
You. Yeah, it was a delight. Okay.
Our guest this hour, Dr. Niobe Way, professor of applied psychology at New York University and president of the Society for Research on Adolescence. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them or to all the emails. We just had a lot on the plate this particular hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. I'm just looking up the article in case you want to read it. It's in the New York Times. On June 16th is the day, so you'll be able to read that article that we've been referencing.